It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Madman, drummers, bombers, and Indians in the summer with a teenage diplomat. In the dumps with the mumps as the adolescent pumps his way into his hat. With a boulder on my shoulder, feeling kinda older, I trip the merry-go-round. With this very unpleasing sneezing and wheezing, the Calliope crashed to the ground. Some old hothead shot was heading for a hot spot, snapping his fingers, clapping his hands.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the point, but better known as WFYI.org because the show's a podcast now. Old habits. Anyway, if you have a question or a comment, like, God, why, go to msoci@wfyi.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter at Matthew Soucy. And this show will remind you, never forget, he said deuce. He said deuce. Joining me in studio is somebody who's familiar with the show. He is the director of government relations at the Nature Conservancy in Indiana, and I guess WFYI alumni emeritus. So you're grandfathered in, maybe?
I think the emeritus would probably put too much pomp on that.
But plenty of circumstance.
There so. You go.
John Katzenberger and Bruce Springsteen fan. John Katzenberger's in studio with me. Hi, John.
Hey, Matthew. How are you today?
This is a day that I'm happy that we get to call this work.
Yes, sir.
This was one of these. At the time of this recording, John and I just literally came back from the movies that we're going to talk about in a little bit. But one of these kind of, it's hooky, but it's not. And I thought we were going to be blown out by Shooter Jennings, who was recording next door for small studio sessions, and that's happened. Anyway, we got a lot to cover and a short time to get there. But that's Jerry Reed. We're talking about Springsteen here. Before we dive in deep, I guess I want to ask, John, how are things at your day job with Nature Conservancy?
Oh, I'm in tall clover.
You're a tall man, so it's regular clover for you.
It's over my head, Matthew. It's a great gig for me. I'm really happy to be working with the Nature Conservancy. We do what I think is very important work, and I'm happy to be associated with people who are very committed to it and serious about it. And it's a lot of fun to see how beautiful Indiana and the rest of the world really is.
There you go. And you can go to follow. What's the website for the organization?
Nature.org/Indiana.
See, so you can check that out. And, of course, John is also on social media. So, go look at his work.
Come find me.
Come at him.
Well, I said come find me.
Find me, right. All right, so reason why we're here and the big show this week, forget everything. I know there are other films opening, but we must discuss Blinded by the Light, a film about it's set in 1987 in small town England, and a Pakistani teenager embraces the music of Bruce Springsteen, as one probably should as a whole. This is from the director, and it's co-written by, and I'm going to butcher this, I'm sorry, Gunder Katta, who gave us Bend It Like Beckham, and there is a very similar vibe to this film with Bendit. It is following one's passions, but also dealing with family traditions and traditional families and the neighborhood that you live in. And it's also a big deal because Springsteen allowed about a dozen or so songs to be a part of this. And we're going to go through Springsteen and cinema in a little bit, because there's actually more on the IMDb than I had anticipated, but I think it's also a process. So anyway, that being said, John, you're my guest. I am your host. Your thoughts on Blinded by the Light, the film?
I have to say that I am biased.
Big asterisk with this
big
program.
Big asterisk. Yeah, I think that's only fair. I am biased. And there were a couple of points where I just thought, oh, my goodness. But in the whole, on the main, I agree completely with your comparison to Bend It Like Beckham. I think that it brings all of the best of those elements together. It was an uplifting and a very happy film. And the use of the music was sometimes comical and sometimes very poignant.
Yep.
And very apt. So I think I would give it high praise, and I actually may go see it again.
Look at that. Well, I wondered if members of your family were a bit miffed that I did not invite them. I don't know.
Oh, you know.
I'm assuming you're the flag carrier of the Bruce-ness at the household.
Yeah, the other side of the household is more Bowie, you know.
Okay, all right. Nothing wrong with that.
Elton John. So we have seen the Elton John biopic, and we are going to go see the Ziggy Stardust when it comes out.
Okay, I have a sidebar for just a minute. Did you say a biopic?
Yeah.
So that's where you stand on the biopic?
You know, as someone who loves movies,
yes,
but is not a cinephile,
okay,
I refuse to be drawn into this. I will not choose a side. If you tell me that it is biopic, I will allow you to have your inconsistency and your wrongness, and I will just move on. I am not going to be drawn into this argument.
No. I'm not trolling. I was curious because a friend of my daughter's is in your camp.
She's correct.
Oh, okay. All right. So, All right. So let's move on to something. Sammy or Dave or what? Joel or Mike. What other camps can we not talk about in this
game? I'm game. Let's have it.
No. Okay. I had to point that out, and now I'm going to back away and back to the review. Okay. What I loved about the film, and this is obviously the biggest achievement, is it shows the universality of Springsteen's work.
Absolutely.
And there are some easy pot shots with, well, other music of the 1980s, known as what high schoolers were listening to in England in the 1980s. It's funny to watch this early on and you think, okay, when are they, because there's an anticipation, I don't know if you looked it up, on which songs they were going to use from the catalog.
Right.
But you know, we're also having to suffer through Cutting Crew and Debbie Gibson and Tiffany, and then we get into the meaty stuff. When this comes out on video, I have not read up on this yet, I will be fascinated to see why he picked what he picked to be used in the film. But yeah, you are right where it is, the songs are used to great effect. You have lyrics printed up on the screen at times, especially when he's having his kind of transcendental moments. I never thought I would hear Born to Run and imagine a kind of Cyndi Lauper-esque video of frolicking and running. But I guess when you're born to run, you can frolic so long as you're moving in a fast motion.
Well, that brings up, I think, an interesting point of the movie. The music was of the era, for the most part.
Yeah, there's a couple
that were chosen.
There's a couple moments I'm going to get to in a moment, but go ahead.
Yeah. So the music was of that era and was you know, either been, you know, in the early 70s, mid 70s, or right there in the mid 80s. So you know, the chronology was right.
Yep.
But I also thought it was interesting that he interpreted songs in a way that were less than obvious, because everyone looks at Born to Run as, you know, I've got to get out of this town, and I've got to go on and do my thing. And that's what the movie is really about.
Unless you're politicians in New Jersey and you wanted to make it the state song.
Oh, and so Ronald Reagan wanted Born in the USA.
I hear Anne Delaney cheering from the rooftop somewhere about that moment.
I won't spoil it for anyone, but there is a beautiful moment in that movie, in Blinded by the Light, which refutes that patriotic nature. And I will argue that it is a very patriotic song. Born in the USA is a very patriotic song, but not in the way most people think.
Like Ronnie.
Like
did,
Ronald
like
Reagan.
Ron did, so.
So, yeah, I thought that was that your observation about the music and the universality is really on point.
Yeah, and I mean, it would be the only other way, and I know they didn't do this, obviously, and it was fine, but it would be like if an African-American kid in the States latched onto Springsteen, and that's well, I can think, you know, but you could, I guess this is the story, you could set it anywhere.
Well, we are the cliches, right?
But we're the dad music.
We're the dad music, but we're also the cliches in that at the time, you know, when I discovered Bruce Springsteen, I was probably 14.
Same here.
And, you know, I am the white kid and I lived in a small town and all of these things.
Therefore, so. Also known as the oppressed. It's been a rough couple of years. Well, and that was, I grew up in Flint, Michigan. I'm fine. But I was the son of a doctor. Uh-huh. So it wasn't quite, you know, high living, but I was doing okay. I was doing, I think, comfortably more than the people in Bruce's songs. So to
right.
see what the lead in this film was going through, it resonated more with his character than I think me. I dug the music and I dug the message, but I wasn't necessarily living it.
Well, it's interesting. No, I wasn't living it either. I have to, you know, I have to confess and admit, and I'm happy to do so.
Right.
I'm very, very fortunate in that regard. But it spoke to me in very much the same way that it spoke to the young Pakistani kid in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to also say that at the very same time, The Clash was very much in my life.
There you go.
So I would argue, and there may be a decent essay in all of this, that the music of The Clash and the music of Bruce Springsteen are subversive in their own ways,
yep.
and also illuminating in their own ways for many reasons, not the least of which are musical,
mm-hmm.
a musical form, musical style, musical awareness,
yep.
and also for the poetry that's involved and the thoughts that come from that.
And both on Columbia. So
oh,
way to go Columbia Records on that one. and also a beautiful use of Jungle Land.
It
does address the relationship between Pakistanis and English, not good. And there is a moment where, and it's a heightened moment involving a family wedding, a demonstration, and that song. And it's used very powerfully. So it does run the gamut of fun to moving, so it's really well done as far as the use of the music. Now there are two points because I'm the guy that, you know, also from the people who created the dude who bids $1 on The Price is Right. In the film, I used to subscribe to Backstreets as well. In the film, he meets another friend and he's the one who really introduces him to Springsteen. He has a couple cassettes. The sidekick, not really sidekick, but the sick friend, gives him Born in the USA and Darkness on the Edge of Town. Two fine choices, by the way, and of course the Born in the USA being the more topical one. And then we have the lovely moments where we're hearing the lyrics, and those who complain about Springsteen singing, yes, you can read the lyrics and understand what he says. Shut up. Yeah, and read Dylan while you're at it. But but the next day, he comes in after having this kind of transcendental moving experience, and he quotes The River. So I'm that guy to point out, like, did you go to an all-night record store in your small town and purchase? Yeah, I know. And I'm going to get to Rocket Man in a little bit because that loosened me up in a little bit. But also the fact that there's a scene in a nightclub and he's listening to Because the Night, which, mm-hmm. of course, the guy up against the wall leaning going, you know, he recorded it, but it was never released until the Tracks box set, which came. I don't know why this guy sounds like Bill Walton, but but
because that's exactly who it is.
That's that guy who did, you know. So those are the two minor musical quibbles. Because there are those guys, and apparently I'm one of them.
And you watch for continuity.
I do.
Gaffes,
I do.
And you watch for, you know.
A little bit. So, but going back to Rocket Man, Rocket Man right out of the gate takes a surreal tone from the get-go. So you can't say when he's performing at the Troubadour in 1970 and he plays, Crocodile Rock, the film has already told you to loosen your sphincter, so.
Yeah, and this film takes itself a little more seriously.
A little more.
But you know, that's cinema's escapism primarily.
Yes, I know. But apparently, I have to be picking my escapes
well. That's okay. That's an attention to detail. That's admirable, Matthew.
Thank you. You're also a fine actor. So,
okay, we're gonna have a fight now.
Oh no. So that's the. But also the father son relationship, which and normally. It is a stock character, the father who just says no to everything. We do get to see some loosening up of him that I don't expect from a Pakistani character in cinema, but that's cool that happens. But it also the parallels between Springsteen's relationship with his own father and the father-son relationship here really, really resonates.
Yeah, especially when it's driven home by a soliloquy by the main character at the denouement. But I thought that the actors, and of course I didn't know any of them. None of them were familiar to me.
You're going to get some hot IMDb scrolling action here on Film Sociology, but go ahead.
Yeah, because the characters were Pakistanis and the British characters are British and it was really cool, really well done. But what I really liked was this director allowed the characters to do some things that in other contexts might just seem cliche or arch. But, you know, there was a point where the English teacher used an expression that I thought conveyed better than any of the sentimental views that she was expressing about our main character's talent. And, you know, when she raised her eyebrows and widened her eyes, I thought, oh, that's pretty nice, you know. And they allowed that. And Dad did that a couple times, too, because he was a hard case, and not very likable, and appropriately so. I mean, that was the tension in the movie, and so I think that the acting was really well done.
It was, and it got a lot of actors. And I'm looking at the lead is, and I apologize for butchering this, but Vivette Carla is our lead. He plays Javed. But he's done two series, Next of Kin and Beecham House, and he's filming a film called Voyagers, and that's it. So right out of the gate, a good start.
He was strong.
Very, very strong. You mentioned the teacher. That's Haley Atwell, if you're of note. And coming off the bench for minor comic relief is Rob Brydon with a really bad wig as Javed's best friend's father, who owns a clothing store on the Saturday market. And took a break from imitating Tom Jones to sing Springsteen along. Yeah, there's also a serenade of Thunder Road, which I wish I could. I shouldn't sing that to Mrs. Soucy, but I know it's the fact that they use that as a ballad, and
it's perfect.
It's a lovely moment.
Yeah, it was.
So, I think if you are not a fan of Springsteen, I think you will obviously enjoy this. It is a sweet story and it's universal as far as we talked about relations with family and your community and meeting a girl and all that and following your path and creating your own niche. But yeah, Springsteen nerds like this show really going to dig it.
Really going to dig it.
So highly recommended on both our parts.
Absolutely.
Now that being said, ladies and gentlemen. In the past year, since probably about a year ago now, we've had the fourth version of A Star is Born. And all that film had to do was be better than Babs' version, and it accomplished that by leaps and bounds. We had Bohemian Rhapsody, a cinematic greatest hits album. Then we had Rocket Man, a cinematic Vegas show for the most part. And then we had Yesterday, a lighthearted Beatles Valentine that was written and directed by the wrong people, in my opinion. And now we have Blinded by the Light. Ladies and gentlemen, I know we don't have much of a voice because we are dad music. You can stop making films about our record collections.
Oh, amen.
I think you're good. You've not really mucked up anything, although the editing in Bohemian Rhapsody, even though it won an Oscar for editing, and then it has been shown that thing is flawed in the editing department, you've not made a colossal disaster. Please stop now. Please quit while you're ahead.
So what are you afraid of? Like AC/DC musical?
No, I'm afraid they're going to butcher like Bowie's story.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's coming.
I know it's coming. And I don't know what else is down the pipe because, you know, this conversation we're having is in development. Until I see a poster or a trailer, I don't care. I really don't care. I mean, I remember back in the 90s, pre-internet, when two friends of mine, now granted they were also two basement-dwelling friends of mine, who almost came to fisticuffs because one was convinced that Kenneth Branagh was going to play young Obi-Wan in the prequels. Remember those arguments? and John, you and I are of the same age bracket. How many years did we hear about Freddy versus Jason, Alien versus Predator, and it was a big, who cares?
I know.
And then, you know, also the fact that one of my favorite filmmakers is Terry Gilliam, and he is almost as famous for unfinished projects like Orson Welles. So,
yeah, how many has he got unfinished now?
Well, he did finally finish the Death of Don Quixote, which I still need to find. It's on streaming. But
good luck.
But I used to say, you know, until I see a poster or a trailer, I don't care. But now I'm like, until I sit in the theater and the lights go down. So, yeah, I know they're going to make more. And I know with if they're making a biopic on Bowie, I hope that they do it similar to Todd Haynes' treatment of I'm Not There, the Bob Dylan film, where you had so many different actors playing the different aspects of Dylan's persona. Yeah, I think you have to do that with Bowie.
Well, okay.
Somebody's got to play Ziggy. Somebody's got to play the Thin White Duke. Somebody's got to play German era Bowie. Someone's got to play MTV era Bowie. I mean, that's that. Unless you can find an amazing actor that looks like Bowie and can sort of pull it off.
Oh, good luck with that.
Yeah, I know. That's a problem.
Never.
Right. So, or just have Cate Blanchett do it.
Probably a pretty good choice.
Or her and Tilda Swinton taking. So it's. The music biopic, and now films like these where we're taking it's not quite Mamma Mia, it's not quite a jukebox musical.
Oh, that's pretty cold.
Well, I'm saying Blinded by the Light is not that. My fear is that it's going to dilute down into that. You just quipped on AC/DC the musical.
I know.
You know that could happen. There's a death. There's.
But it better be Bon Scott AC/DC. That's all I have to say.
Ah, so if John is writing the AC/DC story, we are just covering the Bon Scott years.
It ends before Hell's Bells.
Wow, yeah. Look at that. See, yeah. There we go. So we're not going to get albums. We're not going to get the film about the making of the Razor's Edge, or
yeah, you know, who cares?
Or the songs in Maximum Overdrive.
He's just screaming. He's just screaming.
Wow. So there we go. So yeah, more of these are coming down. I understand that. But on behalf of John and myself, you guys can quit while you're ahead if you really want to. But
or you can take our idea that's in development.
This conversation.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I mean,
this nerd fest, my dinner with Andre.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Saw that in the theater too with my dad. Thank you, Pop. Okay. I want to actually have a short little thing also opening in theaters this week. And then I want to get to Springsteen on IMDb. Where'd you go? Bernadette is a new film from Richard Linklater, and it's starring Cate Blanchett. And of course, every other film is based or inspired by a true story. Thanks. Blanchett plays an architect, a former famous architect who has been out of the scene for 20 years. She has raised a daughter. Her husband is a gentleman who sold items to Microsoft, played by Billy Crudup. And she's stuck in kind of suburban private school mom mode, even though she is the outsider of the group. And there is, on one end, I could sympathize with the film because it's about an artist who has lost her ability to create, and it's getting that spark back. The problem is, while it's a good performance from Blanchett, and Blanchett could read the phone book or do pledge spots, and it'll be, you know, Academy Award nominated material, it's an exhausting character. And even though she's making fun, and the film does sort of poke fun at low hanging fruit of the helicopter parents whose kids are in private elementary school. And that's all wrapped in the character played by Kristen Wiig. You have Judy Greer, who's always funny, also wasted as a psychiatrist who helps try to organize an intervention with Blanchett's character. But it's the ultra uber Seattle. They, you know, all the parents can afford to take their 6-year-olds to private K and pre-K and stuff. So. While I appreciate the story, what they're trying to say, the execution is a little off, and that's saying something because it's Richard Linklater, who's at the very least his misfires are fascinating.
Well, it sounds like it wasn't a total waste of your time.
No, it wasn't. But it was also, as much as I enjoy watching Kate Blanchett, she wears you down a little bit. There's a scene where she's talking to an old colleague played by Lawrence Fishburne, and she is telling the story of what has happened when she was living in Los Angeles, and we hear it cuts to her daughter watching a documentary about her mother. And finally, Fishburne kind of sees that she's putting a period on a sentence and says, "Are you through?" And that's how I felt about the film. It's a film, and I'm paraphrasing because Blanchett says this near the end of the film. She's not leaving a message on a voicemail. She's leaving a diatribe.
Oh.
So
I mean, it sounds like it's a Philip Roth novel, or something like that. But it also sounds like it, and I have to confess, I have not seen the movie.
Right.
So I'm going by your description of it imagining these things. But right. It also sounds like it could be, a little bit of the times and some commentary of the widening, the disaffection in the upper middle class and mm-hmm. the widening gap and the aching notion that, there's a whole life out there beyond money and status and it's creativity and it's the... it's the desire to be part of a society rather than in an enclave.
And there is this, and she wants to create, but she also has her process is to not be around anybody else while doing it.
Oh,
and
well,
it,
that shoots that theory all
well,
to pieces.
Well, no, but there is a climax that involves a trip to Antarctica, and also when the film comes out on video, and I rent physical disc, but the making of, I want to know how much of it they were able to shoot on location. And how much of it they were able to digitalize. Linklater is a smart enough filmmaker. I know he's, and there's only a couple moments that I kind of cocked my head and went, are we green screening this or not?
Well, they better hurry up and get to Antarctica if they're going to shoot films of snow and ice.
Right. From the land of the ice and the snow, Immigrant Song.
You're going to say that Led Zeppelin is going to be the next one to be jukebox.
Oh, gosh, no. If you've read Hammer of the Gods, you really shouldn't film that. I think The Dirt was enough from Motley Crue, that just made it to streaming. Anyway, I forgot to mention, it's good to be back after a 2-week vacation. I was in Edinburgh, Scotland, with my wife and some of her students for the Fringe Festival. And maybe if there's time, I'll tell you about the 6 films I watched on the 8-hour flight to and from Scotland. But by the way, to a certain degree, if you watch a film on a plane, I don't think it really counts.
Why? Not,
well, because I was exhausted for 3 of them. So I might have not been in the best frame of mind to give you a review on this show.
Oh, so you're the person who never falls asleep at the movie.
Oh, it's happened. I don't want it to. My fear, of course, is snoring. There is a famous critic that I know very well and adore, and we all do. And it was, I believe, the first Lord of the Rings that we could hear a little bit of snoring in the background. But we're all guilty of that. But there's also the mindset of being on an overnight flight. And I'm like, I think I'm just staring at the screen as opposed to trying to write a review for the program.
Well, and I admire your willingness to work both to and from Edinburgh. But you've kind of glossed over that you were at the Fringe Festival.
Yeah. Well, I try not to.
Live theater.
I can humble brag, sure. There is a local author in Richmond, Kate Glenn of the Two Sisters Bookstore fame. She has written a sci-fi adventure comedy fun show called The Misadventures of Martin Hathaway. And it's a lowly school teacher who falls through time and space and lands in the coffee table of a captain of a floating sea pirate ship. Run by a female, Daisy McNamara, and it's that adventure. So, for lack of a better comparison, Doctor Who and Harry Potter and all the other very English adventure stories with wit and witticism and steampunk stuff. So my lovely wife, Lynn, got to adapt it for the stage. We did it at Earlham earlier this year, and then we did a Fringe version, about a 80-minute production, and we took it to Fringe. So
that's cool.
It was. It was a lot. I'd never been to Scotland before and absolutely enjoyed myself. Every day is leg day. That's my daughter's quote. She's dead on with that. Consumed a lot of quality liquid in Edinburgh because that is a place where you do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did not have a bum meal at all. And had food from all over there. We had Chinese, we had Himalayan, we had Portuguese, we had Italian. I'm a haggis defender. I don't care what y'all say. If you make fun of haggis, and it's a culinary punchline, but if you make fun of haggis and you've eaten cans of Hormel products, you have no room to talk at all.
Yeah, I think that's a very apt way to put it.
I also like scrapple and pork roll.
Look.
Come at me.
Yeah, I'm not. You're no. No, we are completely 100% on this because, you know, I think that if you don't like it, then that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But most of these people who are making fun of these foods have never tried haggis.
Yeah.
Or any of these things.
They know it because Mike Meyer made fun of it.
Right.
In So I Married an Axe Murderer.
Right.
Yes, a nation whose culinary purpose is based on a dare. Ha, ha, ha. Okay, fine.
So there you go.
Yeah. So, by the way, so we took a tour of... one of the castles, and the guide is playing along the way. It's like a 2-hour drive, but they're playing traditional Scottish folk music, and then some contemporary folk music, and then she dug out a classic. What she said was a classic for the college kids, and this was the biggest response the college kids gave. The Proclaimers.
Oh, no.
That was the classic one. They all sang 500 Miles,
oh.
And I get off the bus and, you know, I shake hands with the driver and I say to the guide, of course, no Rod Stewart, no Bay City Rollers.
They just completely missed the boat.
Right. I don't know.
They didn't rock the boat.
They didn't. The other thing about I obviously went to a number of pubs, and a lot of the pubs I went to in Edinburgh, they love American soul. And
nice.
I don't expect when you land on foreign charts that you will get wall-to-wall bagpipes, although there is that out there.
Did you see the flaming bagpipes? That's
no, I did
what
not
I
see the
know.
Flaming bagpipes, but we did attend the military tattoo.
Well, why wouldn't you?
That was something.
That's cool.
That's spectacle. They also did Bruno Mars and music from The Greatest Showman and Phantom.
No,
so,
really?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's like any other marching band. How about that? What's that high school marching band that does Gary Glitter and Deep Purple?
Yeah. So, knock it out,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, a lot of, so I mean, it was wonderfully off-putting to be in a Scottish pub with a pint and I'm hearing Aretha and Otis. I'm like, okay, that's the big impact on American pop culture. Lovely.
You do a lot worse.
Yeah, you could do a lot worse.
That's awesome.
All right. Shifting gears back to Springsteen. So we were talking before getting this set up was Springsteen's been pretty adamant about who he allows and what he allows his music to be used in films. It's not like a giant corporation. And he has say in what he is able
right.
to release. And I went through, I'm on his IMDb page. I think he's loosened up quite a bit since the 2000s.
Well, he doesn't need to worry so much about
probably
it anymore.
Not so much anymore, yeah, because there's 292 credits. But
really?
Yeah.
I would never have thought.
Well, so therefore, I'm not going to list through these folks. I've been known to rattle off IMDb. I will not do that. But I'm thinking about, because John and I are of a certain age, let's say we'll go to 1990. This is even before Streets of Philadelphia. So, I vaguely remember that Hungry Heart was used in something like WKRP and that Born to Run was used in Saint Elsewhere.
Well, I didn't.
Well, and I think also WKRP, of course, they had that long dispute and they put out a box set without some of the music because they couldn't get the rights. But I remember the first film that he was able to put music in was John Sayles' Baby, It's You, which is a really underrated film. Vincent Spano, Rosanna Arquette, 1983, you know, two kids from the other side, opposite sides of the tracks, using Hard to Be a Saint in the City, E Street Shuffle, Jungle Land. She's the one I really remember, and Adam Raised a Cane. Although there's a couple of those songs because it's set in the 50s. Like, E Street Shuffle does not sound like a 50s song. But
no.
I think in this case, Beggars Couldn't Be Choosers. Hungry Heart was used in Risky Business. God, the Slugger's Wife used Hungry Heart, and don't
the
watch Slugger's,
Slugger's
Wife. Oh, my God. What a Hal Ashby film written by Neil Simon with Michael O'Keefe and Rebecca De Mornay. That's a bad film. It's a bad, bad film. Wise Guys used Pink Cadillac. Ruthless People. He wrote Stand On It, I believe, for Ruthless People. A few other TV shows that use songs. Iron Eagle 2 used Trapped. Wow.
What?
That requires watching Iron Eagle 2, and I really don't want to.
I love Springsteen, but not that much.
No. Roger and Me, of course, used in My Hometown. I'm on Fire was used in In Country. God, Badlands was in Thunderheart. He did the cover of Viva Las Vegas for the Elvis tribute album is used in Honeymoon in Vegas. Hungry Heart was used in Peter's Friends. It's actually a little more, and then here we go. Now we're at 1993 Streets of Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. So, I think you're right when you say that things are a little more comfortable now that he doesn't have to worry. Because if you know Springsteen's career, about 75, there were some trust issues with his inner circle.
Yeah.
So I understand his hesitancy.
You know, my copy of Born to Run is among the original ones and has the sticker over the credits on the back.
No, really?
That says John Landau is his producer.
Wow.
So I'm rather proud
of that.
That's
a collector's
fact.
Item.
Yeah, well, I've kind of ruined it otherwise.
It's yours.
It's been abused and used. And
man.
But yeah, that's exactly right, back in the day.
Woo. So, and then I think after the success, and actually after the award for Streets of Philadelphia,
right,
and Justified, he was able to do songs like Missing. He did Missing for the Sean Penn film, The Crossing Guard. It's one of his falsetto tunes. Dead Man Walking he did. And these were specifically for films that I know he kind of championed,
right,
obviously.
Right.
Secret Garden and Jerry Maguire. Lift Me Up for the John Sayles film Limbo. The River is used in Hard Rain.
So even the boss is not infallible.
No, it's not. But and I still think The Wrestler should have won Best Song. No disrespect towards Slumdog Millionaire. But anyway, so yeah, there's more out there now. And of course, he had the fun cameo in Singles. High Fidelity. I'm sorry, High Fidelity.
Okay.
Had one scene as himself.
Well, he
there.
Had kind of a cameo in this movie.
Well, yeah, there's like films that are inspired by a true story. When you stick for the end, you do get you do get footage of the actual people. So it's not just you're not being blown.
I'm talking
about the
interview that is in the midst of the transformation of the main character into a person of action.
That's true. No, you're right.
So he made a bit of a and you're mentioning all these movies that he wrote songs for, and in this movie is a song that was rejected for a movie.
Tell us.
Well, wasn't the song that was supposed to be in Toy Story, the one at the very end there? I can't think of the name of it, but it was during the end credits, Stand With You.
Oh, that was supposed to be in Toy Story?
That's my understanding.
Wow. We'll have to check on that. It was substituted by Randy Newman's, or we're talking about a different...
I think we're talking about a different
song.
Okay,
all right.
But I had maybe I've got the movie wrong.
Okay,
fine. But Bruce had been rejected.
Who does that?
People who don't want to make any money.
Or people who watch Chicago and have him open for them.
Oh, Jesus. Don't get me started on bands that were once great.
Oh, God. Did you really going off topic. Did you see the Netflix documentary about Chicago?
I did not.
It's pretty thorough. The band Chicago has been kind of stained by the 1980s. And by the way, that stain was not did not participate in the interview process for this documentary. But you forget, obviously, from the Transit Authority days up until
Terry Kath's death.
Yeah, what a powerful band.
Oh, my goodness.
Intricacy and horns. One of my shticks that I use is when I'm working on a play, and I always tell people I appreciate your blood, sweat, and tears, and other horn-based rock bands, your Chicago's, your Tower of Power.
There you go.
You know, that sort of, anyway.
What
but
is
it,
hip?
Yeah. But it's a it, no. If you look for it on, are you streaming or are you on cable?
I'm streaming.
Okay, but I believe it's still on Netflix. But,
okay, I'll
but
look
yeah,
for
it's
it.
A pretty good job and really good footage of the old days.
Okay.
So yeah, that's Springsteen. There's a lot of Springsteen in music, so go check that out. I want to shift gears a little bit, and it's weird timing on this because while I was gone, filmmaker D.A. Pennebaker passed away. And even if you've not seen his stuff, and you really should, there are images and moments that have been they're forever immortalized, the most famous being the Bob Dylan video for Subterranean Homesick Blues, a.k.a. the one with the cards.
A.k.a. the one that's been aped so many times.
Right. And for me, the best use of it is Bob Roberts' Wall Street rap in the Tim Robbins film Bob Roberts, which, by the way, an election year is coming up. Watch that film again.
Yeah.
It's sadly there. My daughter, who's 17, she's established some traditions like she must watch the film Election on Election Day.
Good for her.
And I think that's very smart, and that's a great idea. I've also mentioned, you know, how certain there are certain films that are now quote unquote documentaries like Idiocracy,
yeah.
Network. I just bought recently the Criterion edition of Elia Kazan's A Face in the Crowd. Still kind of holds up, folks.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, and Bob Roberts is another one of those.
You know what's even more poignant these days is Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah, that's a pretty good one, Führer. I mean, it's the president. So if we start to hear We'll Meet Again, we're in big trouble. But D.A. Pennebaker, going all the way back to the 1950s and started getting noticed for films, documentaries like Jane, about Jane Fonda from 1962, Lambert Hendricks and Company, one of my wife's favorite vocal groups from 1964, and then in 1967, hit a home run with Bob Dylan, Don't Look Back, a film that kind of turned the music documentary on its ear. A lot of documentaries at that time were, and I say this in lowercase letters, talking heads, and then maybe some music performance, and that was it. And Pennebaker was able to follow around a really surly Bob Dylan, who basically, I think, to this day, just wants to perform and be left alone. And here he is having to answer interview questions with the press and have to deal with People and Donovan and Joan Baez and hangers-ons and go from hotel to car to venue. And so it was kind of a thumb in the eye to something like A Hard Day's Night, where, you know, being a rock star is supposed to be fun and trivial and frivolous and you know, all this fame and notoriety, and he just wants you to leave him alone.
Well, and I think that it's interesting. What I'd like to know is you know, did Pennebaker, what was his attitude about that time? Was he off-put? Was he, you know,
right,
put out? Was he... Because that's the genius of the movie,
mm-hmm,
is that you're capturing, you know, the essence, I guess, of the main character and all of the antagonists around him, and you're bringing it directly to the viewer.
Yeah,
it's penetrating the veil, if you will, and you know, it brings documentary into an era that seems like we've kind of gone into hyperdrive with.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and I've said this before on this program, and John and I talking earlier. If you've not seen the series Documentary Now, if you're a fan of documentaries in any way, you have to see this with the works of Bill Hader, Fred Armisen, John Mulaney wrote a lot of these. But if there are ones that are very similar to what D.A. Pennebaker has done, what Michael Moore has done, what the documentaries on Vice have done, and ESPN, and the food, the art food documentaries that are not Food Network, all of these are taken care of. And so I want to get back to this, but yeah, Don't Look Back. And then his follow-up a year later was the Monterey Pop concert film with a lot of famous footage.
You mean The first Woodstock.
Yes.
Woodstock West.
Woodstock West. The original Woodstock West. Sorry, Altamont. Sorry, Stones. Yeah. I know you didn't ask for that, and neither did we. But you know, this was the footage. Everybody from Jimi Hendrix, of course, setting fire to the guitar, and The Who, and Otis Redding, and Janis Joplin. Criterion has a really nice collection of Monterey Pop. You should check that out. Little Richard, Keep on Rockin'. Original cast album Company from 1970. This is one that is actually mocked in documentary now and still should be watched. Full disclosure, my wife is directing Company this fall at Earlham. So, you know.
Mrs. Soucy is incredibly busy.
She's incredibly patient, too. So,
well, she lives with you.
Exactly. Patience of Job. So, 1 p.m. And then 1971, John Lennon and the Plastic Ono Band, Sweet Toronto. And then I know this is one you said that you had seen, and I've seen it. I have it downstairs and I need to watch it again because sometimes death will just make you watch things. Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars from 1973.
It's good for you.
Really, really good stuff there. Energy War from 1977, Town Bloody Hall, 1979, DeLorean, 1981.
Wow, he was ahead of the DeLorean curve, wasn't he?
Uh-huh.
He was into DeLorean before DeLorean was into cocaine.
And maybe. We'll see about that. Depeche Mode 101, 1989. Jerry Lee Lewis, 1991. Branford Marsalis, 1992. Chuck Berry, 1992. I don't think he slapped Keith Richards in this one. And then his only Academy Award nomination for 1993's The War Room.
Yeah.
Which is also mocked in documentary now. It should still be watched. But it was for a lot of people, the first time you saw the spin doctors, lowercase, of the people behind the scenes. And those, you know, introverts, James Carvel and George Stephanopoulos.
Introverts. Yeah. Well, I mean, the Clinton wouldn't give him access. He wouldn't be a part of it.
But, right.
So he ended up better off.
And it's a more fascinating story.
It's a better story than if Bill Clinton had been the focus of the documentary.
Yep. A few more titles of note. Down from the Mountain, which is the concert film inspired by the soundtrack to Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Only the Strong Survive, a really cool documentary about the Memphis soul scene. And I actually own this because I found it for a buck. Assume the Position with Mr. Wool, a Robert Wool comedic performance about world history. So
was it worth a buck?
Yeah. I have a soft spot for Robert Wool because I enjoyed The Hollywood Nights. And a little bit of his work in Batman, the first Batman film. So there's that.
Nothing wrong with
Elaine Stritch at Liberty. But anyway, but a lot from D.A. Pennebaker. So go look for his stuff if you don't have it already. So before we wrap things up, I guess, John, so what have you watched recently that does not involve research for this program?
Well, you know, when you ask me to do research like we did today, I'm happy to do it anytime.
Thank you.
The homework assignment was not difficult. You know, I'm late to this party, but I have to admit, I've been watching Stranger Things, and I am loving that
show.
Okay. I'm loving Stranger Things.
I need to. I mean, it's, and I've been told it's filled with all kinds of 80s nuggets.
You've
pop
not watched
culture.
It?
My show watching habits are terrible.
Okay, so I'm not going to convince you.
Okay.
I'm not going to even try to argue for it.
All
I will
right.
just say why I think that you might find this a little. It's very cinematic.
I've heard that.
And I am, like I said, late to the game. I sat down on a Tuesday night. I watched 3 episodes. I sat down on Wednesday night, and I watched the other 5.
Oh, my gosh.
In the season. And I didn't regret it in the morning. It's really, really good. I think they do a really nice job of telling a story of its time.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, its time is roughly that of the Blinded by the Light. It's, you know, early
okay.
to mid-80s. And again, they get really good performances. Now, Winona Ryder gets a little on my nerves.
Uh-oh.
Just a little.
Okay.
But, you know, and it's just like a giant mashup of the 80s.
All right.
The imagery, the references, the story.
Mm-hmm.
Nicely done.
And it's third season?
It just dropped its third season recently.
Okay. Yeah. I will consider that. My problem is, and these are first world problems, as we all know here, part of it is I'm so busy trying to watch for what's opening in cinemas on Friday. Right. So 1 week, and I know I can watch them anytime. 1 week I'm seeing something Monday and Thursday. Another week it's Wednesday night and Friday morning. So to plop down and commit to a series, plus the video releases, which I'll get to in a moment, you know, the struggle is real.
Look, you know, I can appreciate that, Matthew, because, of course, you got to make a lot of radio goodness, public radio
goodness,
too.
That's right. Thank you. These are your pledge dollars at work, folks. You need
to
know.
Keep them coming. Keep
yes,
them coming.
Thank you.
So you know that happens. It's, okay. It's understandable. You're given a pass here.
I'll try, but you're not the first person to tell me about Stranger Things.
Well,
I'll just see.
Start
if I
listening
can...
to the chorus, Matthew.
It's not a Greek play. now, new on video this week, and it really isn't anything in the new as far as new films, but Mill Creek Entertainment sent. I was sent a few films, old titles from Mill Creek, and what their packaging is cute. It's a Blu-ray. But
if you're talking about the packaging, then
No. I'm gonna explain it. These are all films. These are all films from the 70s and 80s. Okay. And what they have in common is that they all came in the big VHS box. So the Blu-ray has an outer cover. It looks like the VHS box with the tape pulled out a little bit with the little stickers that video stores have been known to do. Mm-hmm. And then you have the Blu-ray itself. The best of the four films sent. And it was fun to revisit. This was actually the first film we watched when we got back from Scotland. Was Roxanne.
Oh, nice.
Nice. And it's one of those. Emma had watched it earlier this year. Of course, one of the if you want to use films as a gateway to jump into classic literature, I think starting with Roxanne and then reading Cyrano de Bergerac is a pretty good start.
Yeah.
If you especially, and you know, this is in the same ballpark as Clueless, 10 Things I Hate About You, She's the Man.
And an excellent performance by our friend Steve.
Really good performance from Steve Martin.
People don't appreciate how good an actor he is, or can be,
well,
I should
say. Well, and he doesn't have to nowadays. And I think also there was a period where he was doing remakes of anything, and I thought, are you doing this to finance your new play or your tour with Edie Brickell? Because if I know why you're making this junk, I'm okay with it. But there was a stretch of Roxanne and All of Me and... even Grand Canyon, mm-hmm. Even when he was getting out of the slapsticky stuff,
right.
The jerk, you know, your post jerk material, Dead yeah. Men Don't Wear Plaid, I really, really enjoyed.
Yeah.
But yeah, he this is one of the, if not probably the top of the heap. Daryl Hannah's great in it.
Yeah.
Shelley Duvall comes off the bench. And what I always forget is always just as fun is the Keystone Cops that are the firemen in this, including a young Damon Wayans, an older Michael Pollard, Fred Willard dressing up like Don Johnson as the mayor. And it's directed by Fred Shisevsky, and it was shot in British Columbia, posing as, I think, Washington State. But it's a...
Oh, that's a stretch.
Well, you know, trees and hills. But it's one of those, it reminded me of... I've talked about the charming UK films where... you want to live there. And I use, I watched it again when I got back from Scotland, but Local Hero, which is one of my favorites, and it's getting a Criterion release in about a month or so. But I also say Waking Ned Devine, The Englishman That Went Up a Hill and Came Down a Mountain, you know, all of those where it's like, oh, you want to move there. You want to live there. And I think the small town that's in Roxanne is in that league.
Yeah,
everybody's fascinating and interesting and quirky, and you know, all scientists should look like Daryl Hannah. But but it's a fun Steve Martin performance. So anyway, yeah. It's out on Blu-ray. You can check that out. Also received a film called The New Kids, which I remember the poster for it, but didn't see it. It's from director Sean S. Cunningham, the man who gave us the first Friday the 13th.
Ah.
And
that's the one that scared me.
That's, yeah. And this is a brother and sister whose parents are killed in a car accident. The dad is played by Tom Atkins, for you fans of Lethal Weapon and Halloween 3, that guy. Parents are killed in an accident. He is he's a high-ranking, I believe, a colonel in the military. And they go to live with the aunt and uncle who have been estranged for years and years down in Florida, down in deep Florida. And the local bullies kind of come in and just kind of muss things up for them. Now, the two actors of note that are in this, the sister is played by a pre-scandal Lori Loughlin.
Oh.
So, yes, you cannot digitally erase her from this film,
it's
folks.
It's relevant.
Sorry. Well, is
it's timely.
It? It's timely, but not planned, I think. And the leader of the bully pack is a blonde and very southern James Spader.
Oh, my.
This is 1985, so this is before some Kind of Wonderful and Pretty in Pink. He had already done Tough Turf for you fans of New Line Cinema. So he was kind of establishing himself as the offshoot of the Brat Pack, I guess. So, and it's kind of a, you know, you're pushed until you're pushed no more, but it's not Death Wish, and it's Sean Cunningham. So there's a few grisly moments, uncomfortable moments, and a climax that involves guns and an amusement park.
Because
it's the 80s.
Why not?
Yep. So that is also out on Blu-ray. Also out on Blu-ray scent was from 1975, the Western, modern Western, therefore it's trucks, not horses, White Line Fever, starring a young Jan Michael Vincent and Kay Lenz. Oh, we're digging deep, folks. So
this is deep.
And it's,
I remember the posters, never saw the movie.
Right, and as well as I think Tarantino would gush about
and
you know, talk for 30 minutes about it. But yeah,
so influential.
He's an honest trucker who gets into a dirty business of trucking. This is 2 years before Smokey and the Bandit, folks.
Yeah.
And he is also, like the children in The New Kids, he's being terrorized by the not-so-nice truckers. And Jonathan Kaplan directed this. This is a guy who a decade later would direct The Accused and Bad Girls. But he came from that kind of AIP, independent, Roger Corman, Sam Arkoff, independent filmmaking. And this was his, I believe, his first big studio hit. But yeah, Jan Michael is in this before, and this is after The Mechanic, before Hooper. He was just starting the... Get
he's not
his
a
own
cliche
as,
yet.
Not, no, and it, yeah, way before Airwolf. Yeah, it, he had also had not discovered cocaine yet, apparently.
Yeah, well,
so, as you mentioned, using your words there, but it's also the film at times wanted to be a Sam Peckinpah film. It also probably helped that you cast Slim Pickens, L.Q. Jones, R.G. Armstrong. This is a murderer's row of that guys from the 1960s and 70s.
Wouldn't that be interesting to be the casting director on movies like that? Because, you know, you just pull out that one page and you say, okay, we got another one.
Yep, Strother Martin's not available. How about R.G.? How about, seriously, you know, just guys that you know they're going to be fine even if the film is not.
And often the film was not.
That's true. So this one, it's a low budget affair, so I would say this is pizza and beer movie night if you must.
Go.
So, and then finally of the and this is not of the 80s titles, but it was also sent to me, the 1963 film The Ugly American, starring Marlon Brando as a new American ambassador for a fictitious Southeast Asian country who's on the brink of civil war, but he's there to try to smooth things out because there's an American project going on and construction. And he's also, we find out, he's got a past from and was friends with a guy who is turning out to be the revolutionary One for Change. And Marlon Brando's character is kind of stuck in the middle. Brando's really good. Kudos to the actor who... And I'm terrible with names, I'm sorry. But he stands toe-to-toe with Brando in a scene, which is hard to do because Brando had an ability of chewing scenery and putting a scenery in a headlock and just...
Especially at that point
good
in time.
And this was before he really went off the rail. He was still deemed troublesome, but it wasn't 70s troublesome.
No.
It was 60s troublesome,
yeah.
So... it's interesting, and he grew a mustache, and people think this might have been Burt Reynolds' inspiration for his look in the 70s, but, and it's shot in Thailand, and of course there's a big explanation at the beginning saying this film is not reflect the views of those people in Thailand because it's a fictional Asian country.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the other actor of note in this, Pat Hingle, plays one of the project workers, and Hingle's another one on that list if you needed that guy
list,
from the 70s. Yeah.
Right.
So anyway, that is all out there on video. Did you see Once Upon a Time in America?
I did.
What did you think?
I shrugged my shoulders.
For those listening at home.
That's good radio, isn't it?
He shrugged my shoulders. That's great on TV, John.
Yeah,
but
sorry. I had a little flashback there, Matthew.
That's okay. That's all right.
This thing in front of me with the WFYI flag that looks like a, you know, is a microphone. So I'm sorry about that.
Not a problem.
But I guess I would answer that.
How many H's is in that?
About seven.
Seven or eight. Okay. Yeah, yeah. You're in my wife's camp.
Yeah, afraid so.
She was, we saw this on Tuesday because, again, family night.
Yeah, and gone for a while.
Yeah, we were gone. So, yeah, I didn't, and I fortunately, Emma and I loved it. I was very lucky. I didn't read a thing about it, so I didn't know how it was going to end. And I'll be vague
avoid
about
the,
it. I'll
the
be
spot in the spoiler.
Right. Lynn was done with the film when DiCaprio returned from Italy, and the film clocks in at about 2:40, and it is kind of a lazy romp because we have.
Lazy romp. That's or excessive.
Okay, fine. Excessive. See, it's an homage. It's stealing. It's a biopic.
Wait a minute. You were the one that said Mrs. Soucy is eminently patient. So yes. If she lost patience for this movie, like I did, then
okay.
I think that says much.
There you go. Yeah. Yes, dear. And
biopic.
Yes, dear.
Biopic.
Fine. It's an eye exam. So
none of those people are still listening.
I know that's true. That's probably true. But I loved. So you have the DiCaprio story, and you have the Brad Pitt story. You have a little bit of Margot Robbie as Sharon Tate, and you got the Mansons kind of. So there's four stories, and I'm sure I believe John is like, get these stories together faster, please. I love.
Point?
No, I'm just saying.
No, not your point. Oh, their point.
Their point, right. So
I know you'll get to yours eventually. I wondered about that.
Thank you. I loved the capturing of California at that time. And I'm going to tell the young people before I yell them to get off my lawn. You can come on the lawn for a moment. But at that time, and especially with the Al Pacino character, of the pecking order when it came to show business.
Yeah.
It captures that really, really, really well. Nowadays, nowadays in England, it's never really been that problem. Stage, screen, television, for that, a lot of people in England and the UK, it does not matter. It is work. It's loosening up a little bit here in the States. Many people have said that there's more interesting stuff on television and streaming than there is in the movies. And you have movie stars invading Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
So it's loose. There is no pecking order. There is a pecking order, but it's a little more open.
Right.
In 1969, if you were a movie star and you moved to television, you were pretty much done.
Toast.
And that is addressed in this. Or the other alternative, and DiCaprio's character did not want to do it, go make westerns and action films in Italy.
Mm.
And a lot of actors in the United States did that. Clint Eastwood did it. Burt Reynolds did it. There's a wonderful documentary, if you can find it, called Eurocrime. Mike Malloy has been on this show about the mob and cop films from Italy in the 1970s. And it employed Martin Balsam and George Kennedy and Henry Silva and Fred Williamson and all these guys that, you know, maybe the bloom is off the rose a little bit by 1974, or they weren't getting enough that guy calls in the mm-hmm. States, but they could star in a movie in Italy. So it captures that well. The part involving the Mansons, and there's a particularly tense scene involving Brad Pitt, who plays DiCaprio's stuntman, when he is kind of surrounded by, and Quentin uses Once Upon a Time as a reason. One, it's storytelling, and two, he loves the westerns of Sergio Leone. You know, there's that particular tense moment. A lot of walking in this film because there's the only thing missing are spurs, that jingle, jangle, jingle.
And maybe the soundtrack, you know, the sound effects, like the whistles.
Right, not enough Ennio Morricone.
There you go, thank you.
Although, you know, Morricone got an Oscar for Hateful Eight, and rightly so, but there's a lot of source music, and not the obvious choices for music. You know, the film uses the original album cut of You Keep Me Hanging On by Vanilla Fudge, which has been in my head all week. It helps balance out Robert Goulet singing MacArthur Park on television. which nobody really asked for MacArthur Park, period.
Yeah, much less from Robert Goulet.
Right. So anyway, so there's that. And then we get to and Margot Robbie, who has a lovely performance as Sharon Tate. And I know there was some criticism because some people have said it's a silent performance. And what I think Quentin wanted to do, he did not want to make Sharon Tate one of the girls in Death Proof. Didn't want her to be Uma Thurman. He didn't want to sound like a Tarantino character.
Right, right, right.
So to keep it less is more, there's a sequence in the film early on, it doesn't really give away anything, where, you know, DiCaprio's character was apparently up for the Great Escape. And there's fun use of digital in that. But we don't see Margot Robbie on screen in The Wrecking Crew. We see Sharon Tate.
Yeah.
Now, without giving away anything, so here's the non-spoiler spoiler. My wife had not seen Django Unchained or Inglourious Basterds. So she was not aware of Quentin's revisionist cinematic revenge films.
I'm with her.
So yeah. You have also not seen those
no.
two? Oh, my goodness. So
yeah,
that
I'm
really...
I'm not a
Quentin guy?
No.
So I will... Let me ask questions and we'll keep these short answers. I think we were really expecting a dreadful moment because of
the
history,
circumstances.
Yes. Were you happy or unhappy with the result that they used in the film?
Can I shrug again?
He shrugs. Yes, you just did. So in parentheses, John shrugs.
John shrugs.
Okay,
yes.
So didn't really go either way.
No.
Okay, all right. So my daughter, who knew a little bit about the incident and the piece of history, she enjoyed it. Once that happens, I went, oh, so I know how this is going to end. And it does. So...
But you're a Tarantino guy.
I am a Tarantino guy, and there's a part of it like you could have, and I think you probably could have loosened, you kind of shaved a few frames out of that particular sequence, especially with the dog and a few other things. But, and there's
Quentin.
Yeah, but it's, you know what? Quentin makes these films the same reason why dogs lick their elbows, because he can. So you got to, I guess, in some cases,
I have grudging respect for his ability to make these films.
Exactly. So there is that. So John shrugged. I did not. Actually, we may have to make that a logo or something on there. So now, there's and last week in the AV Club, they had a fun primer about a lot of the references used in, like, Hullabaloo and a lot of the films that are mentioned. Will Once Upon a Time in Hollywood make you want to watch something like The Lady in Cement? The Frank Sinatra? Or, you know, any Italian cop films starring
No.
American?
No? No.
Anything directed by Sergio Corbucci? The
No.
second greatest Italian Western director of all time?
Yes, that's right. Second greatest. Whoa.
Sergio Corbucci is, and he's mentioned in this, of course, Sergio Leone did the trilogy and Once Upon a Time in the West and Once Upon a Time in America. Sergio Corbucci's big that he did the original Django, the one with Franco Nero, also did a film called Navajo Joe with Burt Reynolds. This is 1966. It's Burt Reynolds said, "I wore a fright wig. I look like Natalie Wood." Yeah, he plays a Native American who's left for dead, and he takes out revenge one by one in Corbucci style.
Wow.
And there's also a film called The Great Silence, which Film Movement put out last year from 1968. Klaus Kinski is in it. And it's one that, well, with Django, they shot it in mud. So, because I think we were used to just dusty, dry, dusty Westerns.
Right.
For Django, they shot it in a muddy, muddy cake, because that seems a little more realistic in your Western towns. The Great Silence is shot in the snow.
Oh.
And on top of that, and really a spoiler alert on a 51-year-old film, it's a really bleak ending. Bleak ending. And I think for a lot of us, when we go to Westerns, there's, even though there is... gray areas in the spaghetti westerns, and you know there aren't any black or white hats, but we expect a certain conclusion. You don't get that in The Great Silence. So thank you, Sergio Carbucci, for all your work.
That is an amazing and marvelous tangent.
A.K.A. your pledge dollars at work.
I'm lost.
No, it's fine.
I'm in the cul-de-sac. I can't find my way out.
No, you're wasted and you can't find your way home. Thank you, blind faith.
See? We knew we'd get back there somewhere.
Exactly. Well, once again, John, plug your business, and I appreciate you hanging out, man.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to hang out, and I'm with the Nature Conservancy now. I ask policymakers to do the right thing by our Earth, and sometimes we're successful and sometimes we're not, but we're always out there trying, so... Happy to do it.
Keep fighting the good fight.
Thank you.
Now, normally I would say, well, ladies and gentlemen, words to live by, of course, Soylent Green is people, Zardoz has spoken, but we're going to end the show today with, well, we mentioned it earlier, and so get your place cards ready, but thanks for listening. Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there, and get some Springsteen in your collection. You
Amen.
Really should. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD To The Point and WFYI .org. Sure. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
John is in a basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on a pavement thinking about the government. The man in a trench coat, batch out laid off, says he's got a bad cough, wants to get it paid off. Look out, kid, it's something you did. God knows when, but you're doing it again. You better duck down the alleyway, looking for a new friend. A man in a coonskin cap and a pig pen wants $11 bills. You only got 10. Maggie comes fleet foot, face full of black soot, talking at the heat, put plants in the bed, but phone's tapped anyway.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!